In 2014, WNYC tried a couple of different ways of reaching new audiences through podcasting. We developed one show in-house, a show called Death, Sex, and Money that was the idea of one of our news reporters. Her name is Anna Sale, and she had an idea for a show that talked about the things people don't talk about, death, sex, and money. Frank conversations with celebrities and people just like you and me. We also decided that it was not enough to – we couldn't grow enough shows in-house fast enough, that we needed to look outside the building. We were looking for projects that involved women. Specifically this year, we got a grant from the CPB to develop women's programming. And we were also trying to find subjects and topics that would be – that we knew were of interest to public radio audiences. So we formed partnerships with two existing shows, The Longest Shortest Time – is a parenting podcast hosted by Hillary Frank, who's a longtime This American Life contributor. It's a show that really delves into the difficult, often difficult stories of people having children and attempting to raise them through sometimes tremendous, against tremendous odds. And we also then launched a partnership with Dan Pashman, who's the host of a podcast called The Sporkful. And it's really one man's obsession with eating and how to get the most out of every bite that you take of food. It's a very funny show. Both of those shows had grown to a level that made them competitive in their categories, parenting and food, but that needed full-time production help, a chance to benefit from the kinds of marketing and promotion that we can do for a station of our size. We can essentially advertise these podcasts to our audience and get them interested in it in a way that's much faster than if the podcast hosts themselves are simply trying to do it on their own through, you know, iTunes reviews and so forth. So we're looking at models that allow us to do fairly rapid growth with the audience, that serve our audience's core interests, and that brought new voices, younger voices, to the air.
And there's Sideshow and TLDR too, right?
Oh, yeah, I didn't even get to those. Two more. We have two other shows that were grown in-house. Actually, TLDR, a show that was started under On the Media, the show On the Media from WNYC and NPR, that started as a side project. Two of the producers of that show entered a contest I ran last year, the same contest that Anna Sale entered, and came up with a show idea about the internet and how to explain the crazy things that just happen in a week on the internet. And they were backfilled on their production duties for On the Media for 90 days to see what they could do in 90 days. And after 90 days, the web traffic that they generated was so great that we found a way to take them off of the radio show and have them work exclusively on TLDR. So you have to be able to – what that example actually shows you that you have to be able to react fairly quickly. When you have a success, it's important to try and capitalize on it as quickly as you can. And it's a hard thing, I think, in public radio. We're used to creating shows that run – you start them, you spend a lot of time crafting a radio show. It has taken in the past anyway 3 or 4 or 5 years for it to catch on. Every program director has to be persuaded to put it on. If it's a good show, people like it, and then it starts producing membership revenue and underwriters are attracted to it and the live events you do are greeted by thousands of people. That's the path to success in traditional public radio ways. But now, in a time in which the audience's attention can shift rapidly from one thing to another, if you do see something succeeding right away, I think you have to seize the moment, reallocate your resources if you can, or essentially just find a way to get it done so that you don't miss an opportunity when you have something that's successful to help grow it as quickly as you can.
So talk a little bit about the contest in-house. How did that come about?
Well, I got this long title, and I needed to do something with it. So I ran a contest in the winter of 2013 in which I invited staff at WNYC. We're a station of about 350-ish people, I would say, to come up with a show idea. Just send me a show idea. I set out some rules. It was a little page and a half long memo that said, explain your idea, explain who you are, explain who you think the audience is for what you're trying to do. And I got 85 entries, which is a lot. I mean, almost, what's that, 1 out of 4 or so, employees in the company sent me ideas. A team of people, colleagues here from various departments, evaluated them. We came up with three that we then thought were worth piloting. Those three received some funding, so those three producers and hosts, reporters, could take some time away from their regular duties, usually about 6 weeks is what we gave them, to do a focused piloting phase of their projects. And then we evaluated them afterwards to see if the way we piloted them worked and if they were ready for some more serious investment. And that is actually the process that led us to Death, Sex, and Money.
What does WMYC get out of all of this? I mean, what's in it for you guys to take those resources and try to launch new stuff?
Well, the future is really up for grabs, I think. I mean, we know people will continue to listen to the radio, but WNYC needs to think about its digital audience, which in sheer numbers really dwarfs the radio audience now. The number of people who listen to our podcasts, Radiolab and Freakonomics Radio, Studio 360 on the media, all those shows, millions and millions of downloads a month. We reach about a million plus people on WNYC AM and FM here in New York, but we're in fact really broadcasting now to a global audience. And we have a responsibility, I think, as a public radio station, as a public media organization, to try to serve that audience that you know, they've contributed for years. They've become members and helped us do public service. We have an obligation, I think, to try to make sure that we continue to serve them in the ways in which they're using media now. We can't just simply afford to sit still. So I think it's my job, working with my colleagues here, to try to find the best new talent that we can, make sure that our own people in-house, it's a tremendously creative staff, make sure that they have an outlet for ideas that they want to explore, and make sure that we are then making serious investments in the ones we believe are going to actually give the audience what it needs and return to us in terms of the investment that we've put into it.
So do you think of podcasts as a testing ground for shows that will eventually be terrestrially broadcast, or do you think of them as a platform in and of themselves?
When I look at the future, and when I look at a show that's in development now, I don't actually think about whether or not it's going to be a radio show necessarily first or a podcast first. I think the ease of piloting podcasts is very appealing. I don't have to fit my content to a specific show clock. It doesn't have to be 54 minutes and 30 seconds long or whatever the duration is that you need for a radio broadcast. Conversations get to be as long as they need to be in podcasting. And I think that's a very good thing in terms of show development, because you can actually be much more critical about the material you're recording and the quality of it. And if you spend an hour in a studio and all you really get is 12 minutes at the end of it, but there are 12 great minutes, that's fine. I don't have to think about what do I do with the other, you know, 48 minutes of that hour. However, I do think, and we've done this, shows that start as podcasts can and many should become radio shows. The audiences are, I think, overlap more than they separate. It's just that we reach fewer people by radio frequencies here in New York than we do through podcasts. And a couple of examples, Freakonomics Radio started as a podcast, and I think in the second year we did 5 radio hours, which we distributed with APM across stations in the country. We did 10 hours the year after that, and people have been really excited to hear on the radio, Freakonomics Radio, the podcast. And I think it's very important for the development of our podcasts that we find new audiences who don't know about our stuff because they primarily listen to the radio. So they're sort of mutually reinforcing media. The same is certainly true of Here's the Thing, the Alec Baldwin show that we produce. We're in season 3 of that right now. And we'll be doing hours of that and offering them free to public radio stations around the country later in 2015. People who run radio stations always are looking for good content. Programmers always need good content. And so I think It's sometimes more work to try to feed both services. It's sometimes not worth it. But if you have a good show, you can start from either end and make real progress with either audience.
Is it really true that you don't still think, oh, if it's good enough, we'll put it on the air?
When I think about putting a show on the air, I have to think about whether or not the resources that are needed to get it to radio are going to be, whether using those resources is going to be worthwhile. If I take 10 Alec Baldwin interviews from Here's the Thing and edit them, and Alec has to retract them, in order to make 5 hours of radio, there's some work and expense related to making those radio shows. Now, the upside is that if I can get 100 or 200 public radio stations to carry those hours, I may acquire thousands of new listeners for the show, new loyal listeners for the podcast, Here's the Thing.
And more money to support the production.
Well, eventually, yes. I mean, the money, how we fund these things is still something that everyone who does podcasting is learning about right now. We have non-commercial rules for underwriting on public radio. We've been honoring rules in the podcasting sphere that make our underwriting in podcasts sound very similar to the underwriting that we do on the radio. Other podcasters, commercial podcasters, are free to have their host talk for 2 or 3 minutes about, the brand of whisk broom that's underwriting their podcast. We haven't gone that route because we've so far felt that it might diminish our nonprofit status. It might inhibit people from giving and becoming members. And membership is our largest source of income here at WNYC. So, it's not clear to me, and I think some combination of listener support and underwriting is going to be essential both for the commercial and the non-commercial podcasters going forward. Nobody's going to be able to depend on just one thing.
So I want to talk a little bit about tone.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe the difference in tone between podcasts and terrestrial shows?
The difference in tone between podcasts and terrestrial radio shows is actually one of the most exciting things for me about working in podcasts, with podcasts, because I think it's much more informal than public radio has become. It's much more spontaneous. Some people may say, well, it's more crude. It's more, you can hear the edits. It's not so highly polished. But I like the spontaneity of it a great deal. And I think the audience that say the people who have been the first people who really took up podcasting in the last 5 years, who are, say, in their 30s or 40s, have a very different expectation for what they're going to get in their podcast. They like it raw, I think. They don't mind the lack of scripts. I think it can depend very much on the topic and the personality of the host. Some shows sound really raw, and they're actually very carefully edited. But I think the unscripted nature of a lot of podcasting, makes it more exciting to listen to. The downside of it is that some podcasts are 2 hours long and they really shouldn't be. Some people have trouble editing themselves. I was listening to a show last night while I was flying back into New York, and it had a celebrity guest that I was really interested in hearing about. The podcast was 2 hours long. I had 1 hour left in the flight, and I only began hearing the celebrity guest in the last 5 minutes of the flight. And it was very disappointing.
Wow.
I kept thinking, well, it's going to come soon if I just hang in there. There's a certain amount of self-indulgence. But, if you're a fan of the host, and that host wants to go on for an hour about something before bringing in the guest, I think you're going to be okay with that. And we as producers shouldn't try to get between the audience and the people they care about.
How is the tone of podcasts, that kind of informality, roughness, going to impact or already impacting what we hear on terrestrial radio?
Well, if you listen to commercial terrestrial radio, it's already really informal. They don't have, you know, rooms of producers supporting the talk show host you hear on talk radio. It's often just the host, maybe, and a board operator, or maybe someone doing a little bit of research. So I think, in a way, podcasting and commercial radio are very similar right now. For public radio, I do think we'll be looking at ways to introduce that kind of spontaneity and sense of fun into the work that we do without, I hope, losing our reputation for providing you with reliable, smart information, things you can use in your everyday life, you know, a sense of what is going on in your community. All the things that we talk about during pledge drives for public radio, I hope will still be true as we enter, you know, a world that's primarily digital. But I'm not sure that it's a bad thing that we are becoming a little less formal.
More broadly, how do you think the much touted and maybe over touted, I don't know, podcast renaissance is going to affect public radio in particular and the listening that public radio audiences can do?
I think podcasting has been the best thing to happen to public radio in my lifetime. Millions and millions of people, for instance, just to use the example of Serial, right? Millions and millions of people who hadn't really used that podcasting app on their smartphone heard about this show and went and listened to it. And then there they were looking at a whole bunch of other shows that they had never heard of before, and I believe sampling them. You know, we have seen really strong growth in all of our shows this summer and fall, and I don't think I think we have to give some credit to Serial for opening a door through which a lot of people have walked for the first time into the kind of listening that we, you know, our core listeners have been doing for a long time on public radio. It has opened up the conversation about the importance of audio in people's lives that I think we had a hard time. We believed it. But folks who work in public radio believe it, and our listeners believe it, our core listeners believe it. They give us money in support of it. But it often felt like a conversation that was happening in the background between listeners and us. And now it feels to me like podcasting has helped make that conversation something that's happening in the cultural foreground.
Another question, another vein. You've had some producers leave WNYC to go work for some new podcast distribution services or some established ones. Could you talk a little bit about some of those leavings? I know that the TLDR guys left to work with Alex Bloomberg and Greta Cohn, some other folks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the podcast economy is pretty brand new, and there are terrific opportunities for people who have worked long and hard on behalf of whatever shows all over the country. Right now, you know, for most of my career, if you wanted to work in public radio and you wanted to climb the ladder, you moved from station to station to station. And the jobs were not very many, and you had to I would say most producers had limited opportunities because most stations are pretty small and most stations don't have a lot of resources, and they may only produce one or two local, two would be a lot of local talk shows where you could learn the craft. Or if you're a reporter, you'd have to move from market to market to market as you try to work your way up to a bigger market if you're ambitious. Because the economics of podcasting, smaller staff, easier, cheaper distribution, mean that we can have many more podcasts, suddenly there are many more opportunities for people to go out and do their own thing. I mean, you don't need a radio studio anymore. You just need your living room and a $200 microphone and a laptop, and you can make a show. So I think it's an exciting time. If I were 25 now, I would probably be following in the footsteps of those plucky, independent, now independent producers who've decided they don't necessarily need to be at a public radio station in order to do what they love doing.
Well, do you see the podcast kind of the podcast economy, as you call it, mm-hmm. as competition?
Well, it is in some ways. I mean, I don't know that the pool of funding is infinite for all of these things, but I still feel as if, let's say, startup from Gimlet is a success, which I think it is, a pretty big success, I don't see how that really hurts me. Again, it's sort of the serial factor. It brings more people in who may not have known that, you know, about Freakonomics Radio, but if they see Freakonomics Radio right next to startup in the iTunes podcast top 10, then I have a really good shot at claiming the same listener for my show too. I think what it really does is makes me want to make sure that we're doing the best shows we can so that we are competitive. I think our competitive advantage is that we produce very good shows, and I hope I can continue to try to help us do that, because I think that's really the differentiating thing is quality. And I do think shows with great personalities and of high quality will always find an audience.
Something that's been interesting for me to watch is the departure of public radio producers to for-profit podcast yeah. venues. And I think, you know, when podcasting first got started, the quality generally was not awesome. That's sounded right. a lot like commercial talk radio, which doesn't appeal to me particularly. But it's been very interesting to see that public radio pedigree move into a for-profit
well,
sphere.
Public radio has trained very successfully an awful lot of really talented people. People have spent 5 or 10 years working their way around various shows. There's a tremendous talent pool that public radio has generated for audio generally. And it just doesn't surprise me if someone has a good idea. Not every idea is going to be greenlit in every business. So if you have an idea and just need to go do it, I don't think there's no way to stop someone who's really driven to perform. And I actually love those people the most. The people who are really driven to do something, even if they have to leave me to go do it, because for whatever reason I can't help them at the moment, I can't begrudge them that, because how many chances do you get in life?
There's no, you don't feel any kind of soreness about like having fed the competition unintentionally?
No, because who knows? In next year they could come back here and work for me. Or maybe I'll be working for them one day. I may need a job sometime soon after this interview, possibly.
Do you have a sense of urgency?
Yes. I do feel a sense of urgency to make sure that we have a process in place for developing shows on a regular basis and for funding them long term should they succeed. You want to make sure a lot of show business is gambling, really, with other people's money. And when you're in a listener-funded organization like WNYC, you take that responsibility pretty seriously. I can't just throw money at things without really studying whether or not they have the potential to grow, whether or not they suit our mission, whether or not we have the resources to support what they want to do. And so thinking about all those questions can certainly leave you at the end of the day with a certain amount of urgency, feeling a certain amount of urgency. But yeah, and I think audience tastes will shift over time as they find and explore this world. I hope we'll be lucky enough to keep coming up with really original things and help lead that conversation.
Great. And if you had a message, like say I was a 55-year-old, mm-hmm. longtime public radio supporter, I listen only terrestrially, and I'm hearing all this buzz about podcasts, and maybe I'm feeling like, well, what does this mean for what I'm hearing? Mm-hmm. What would you say to me?
I can't see FM radio stations just folding up and disappearing really anytime soon. I do think we're in undoubtedly a period of great economic change, but I think something like, I saw a study from Edison Research this summer, something like, you know, 90%+ of the country listens to terrestrial radio every week. And the number is drifting down very slightly, but it's not going off a cliff. Public radio stations all around the country still have a very vital mission. When there's an emergency, when there's breaking news, when there is an event like the demonstrations in Ferguson, Missouri, for instance, this summer, I'm not sure a podcast can cover that the way terrestrial radio can cover it. I'm not sure a podcast can do what we did for New York during Hurricane Sandy. There are some things that live radio is really necessary for. Now, it may be live radio that's still streamed on your phone. Like, the machine is not something you should worry about. I think the need for the service that public radio provides will continue to be there, and I believe audiences will still support it because they value it. It has an impact on their lives.